Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Dow where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, mother! Do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
One more pick, Saxon Jackson. I'm to my rookie on the board. SP Futures up 60. NASDAQ Futures up 440. That's a big rally. This is after yesterday. We sold off with the, the S&P was down 91, so we're back about two-thirds on that. NASDAQ was down 354. But yet another government-inspired. Intel surges 9% after Trump says company will partner with Apple on U.S. chip design. What in God's name is that Trump's business? Do we think that, how many shares do you think him and his gang of cutthroats bought before that announcement? Anyway, do we have Professor Liu?
What's up?
How are you? Intel's up. Did you get the call?
I did not. And I'm not on that list, apparently.
How come so many supporters are happy not being on the list? Shouldn't all the supporters be on the list?
No, not necessarily. His list of supporters, I suspect, is substantially shorter this morning than it was a couple of days ago before this MOU got announced with Iran.
Well, it's interesting. Stuff you listen on the radio driving in, they just sentenced a policeman in, like, Phoenix, Illinois, or some god-awful little south suburb. And, I won't say god-awful, but a very poor south suburb, to, like, 50 months in jail for taking bribes from people and not giving them a traffic ticket. If you would apply that to what's going on in Washington in the last 20 years, how many people would be in jail for how long?
Lots, I suspect. But, that's been a huge function. Or a huge issue. I was talking with my wife last night about how this MOU thing played out.
And to your wife is positive to start with.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that she still talks to me is kind of a miracle in and of itself. But we were talking about the MOU and the negotiation for it, and I said, I think there are probably 20 different storylines running underneath the face-to-face stuff between the Iranians and us as to why this thing looks the way it does, starting with I'm sure calls from Japan, India, Southeast Asian countries basically pleading for us to do anything to get oil prices back down and get oil availability back in place. We were starting to see and hear about impacts from that when we were in Southeast Asia a couple of months ago about what was happening there and the kind of impact it was having in those economies. So that was one line, I'm sure, that was going, that was or subtext that was running under the negotiations. And then the other is what was happening with the Gulf states and the fact that, you know, the Iranians have been shooting missiles and drones at them and conceivably could do a lot more if they wanted to. At least, I don't know about a lot more, but could do more to damage those economies. And I just noted, you know, the fact that the families of the president and the secretary of the treasury and a number of other cabinet officials have significant business relationships there. And I'm not certain there's a quid pro quo in place, but those kinds of business relationships, as you know, Tom, translate into access. And so those business partners, I'm sure, were calling up the Trump kids and the Bessent kids and the other players in that area and saying, listen, we we don't want to get hit by these missiles, and whatever your dad or whatever the president can do to help us out, we'd really appreciate it. And you know that translated into you know, phone calls to dad and father-in-law and whatever, saying this is going to be a problem. So I'm factoring all that in as to why this looks like such a crazy deal in terms of our willingness to take on these folks with something more than what looks to be a very concessionary kind of arrangement. So, you know, this all ties back to one of your longstanding positions about the interplay between these, you know, the personal relationships and family relationships and foreign policy, domestic policy, whatever. I'm sure that happened, and I'm sure it was just one of the subtexts on why we ended up with the arrangements we did.
Well,
I don't like.
I'm not so sure I do either. But you know, if you look at, you know, people shooting off their mouth, I'm not going to say totally lying, although I could say that. It's the inconsistencies.
Which, by the way, is what I do here regularly.
So. I don't think so. I don't think you ever told a lie here in your life.
Shooting my mouth off.
But the whole U.S. on the world stage, if you listen to some of these, to people coming from outside, and I guess it's the one good thing about YouTube. I don't listen to the commentary, Lou. I've stopped that. Because if you listen to commentary on the right and the left, you get kind of diffused. But I just listen to what people are saying and try and make my own judgment, which you're not supposed to do, I know, these days. But the inconsistency, if you're some bozo living in New England or New Zealand, you go, what's this guy talking about? 6 months ago or 8 months ago, he said he knocked their nuclear stuff back to wherever. All of a sudden, it's back to wherever. Oh, no, wait a minute. They got all this stuff. Well, we're going to open up the strait. Well, it was open before you got there. I mean, the amount of inconsistency. I mean, there's only so much congratulations you can give to the guy who put out the fire, who started the fire. I mean,
let me, and this is something about the strait. The strait was open only to the extent that we were paying ransom. And the ransom that we were paying was the toleration of Iranian proxies trying to destroy Israel, shooting missiles into the Red Sea, trying to close off the Red Sea, the toleration of Iranian agents trying to assassinate people in Europe and in the United States. We tolerated that. The West tolerated that, and that was the trade off. The minute we step in on that and try to shut it down, we get the straits closed. So the straits were open, but they were open only because the West was paying Danegeld in terms of the tolerating the Iranian foreign policy.
Well, you're absolutely right, Lou. This is a multi-level discussion. I can't argue with that. I honestly can't. You're right. But I listened to the who's the guy who runs India? I remember all these names.
Modi.
Well, he was on it. Was he part of the G7? He must be. So
yeah.
They're giving him this, and I'm not a big fan of the guy, but he starts launching into this thing, and I can't remember. I was trading while I was listening. He started talking about in the last 4 or 5 years something about they never really bought a lot of oil from Russia. They bought it from the Middle East, and something was going on in the Middle East. I forget the crisis at the time. They start to run together. He said the U.S., was Trump's first term, I think. He said, asked us to buy oil from the Russians to stabilize the oil market.
Yeah.
So then we start buying oil from the Russians, and all of a sudden, like 2 years later, it's, no, wait a minute, you can't buy oil from the Russians because now we're sanctioning them. And now, 6 months ago, you can buy them from them again. He goes, what is going on? What's with these people?
Well, and this is... I
yeah, I'm no fan of his.
We don't need to beat this to death because it's being pressured or it's being hammered by every other commentator. But this whole situation is untenable, was untenable, and was and we ended up we ended up with an administration that said, look, I think we can take this on. We're going to take advantage of the fact that the Israelis have decapitated leadership in Hezbollah, in response to what happened in Gaza, have eliminated another Iranian proxy there, or have neutered an Iranian proxy there. They've demonstrated the ability to effectively fly and molest it over Iran to drop whatever they need to drop. We're going to take advantage of that to deal with a problem that is not going to go away. And we tried within the limits of whatever our democratic polity allows. The big fit, there are several failures here that I don't know. We don't know. And let me say this. We don't know how this is going to play out. This is still very much in flux in terms of whether this was a strategic blunder or not. Nobody can predict it. All I can say right now is I don't like the shape of what's come out in this MOU. But, you know, if we have the will to enforce the requirements of that MOU in our favor, then this could all work out just fine. I don't want to be a doomsayer at this point, but we entered into this thing hoping it was going to go quickly. I will say that our intel was not, and you know, maybe the Israelis weren't as omniscient as we think, but our intel was not good. And I'm not going to blame the president for relying on his intelligence people, who told him, listen, if we put a chokehold on these guys for, you know, a month or a month and a half, their economy is going to collapse. I said that. I was reading the same reports you were. I thought that was going to happen. We just weren't able to bring them to the table with what we were willing to do. The biggest failure of this thing, in my mind, is not this deal. It's the failure of the president to articulate concisely and understandably what the goals were in terms of how we were gonna try to get there, and you know, sell this to you know, the American people. I don't think they did a good job of that. I wish he had gone to Congress and said, look, this is what we need to do, and this is why we're going to do it, and try to get some congressional support. Maybe that ship has sailed, because he perceives that he will never, ever get a single Democratic vote in Congress. Maybe that's the case. But that, to my mind, is the biggest failure here. The strategic stuff I can understand. I understand why we're doing this. If we have allies that are telling us their economies can't handle another month of these prices, I get that. I don't like it, but I get it. What I don't get is the failure to really generate political support for this within Congress and within the public.
I have only two sort of things, Lou, and please, you know, grade me on this, because you're the expert. I actually thought, now again, I'm not tied into this. I will say one thing about the intelligence. If a friend, Mike Murphy, who was in Army intelligence, every time somebody says the intelligence was bad, he bristles. He goes, whenever it's bad, it's because people didn't listen. Because it's usually pretty good. It's basically what his, anyway, being in there, that's, you know, that would be his view, and he's probably right. Two things. I know that you know that I know I don't want any part of the Iranian, you know, religious takeover, blah, 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 you know, beat up people or kill people that don't wear a scarf. I mean, I want no part of that. You know that. It's totally not us. It's not even in the same book. We agree on that, I think. Yet I honestly thought that in the last year or two, some Biden, some Trump, between the Houthis kind of getting the shit kicked out of them, it looked like Israelis were winning against Hezbollah and Hamas. And I actually thought for the first time Iran was really on their heels to the point where they were probably the weakest. Now, this is one man's opinion, just reading the stuff.
No, I agree with you.
They were probably the weakest.
Right. I think, Tom, that's what triggered this.
Well, but I'm saying, and I think somehow or another, there's this thing between Netanyahu and Trump. I've heard three or four generals say, and they, you know, they, who knows if they're Democrat or Republican, they said, the guy's been asking us to do this for 40 years, and everybody said no, till finally. But the other thing is, I read this article, and why how I got onto this, I have no idea. Did you send it to me? Maybe somebody did. It had to do with succession in Iran. Because the what's his name? The Ayatollah, he's, what is he, 80-something? He was up there.
The one we killed?
Yeah,
the one he's killed?
Yeah. He was, okay. And they said, actually, at this stage of his life, he was probably the most moderate of the people that could come after him. And there was a whole thing of the succession. And they said, the person you don't want in charge is the kid, because he's a total asshole. And the only way he's going to get in, because you're supposed to go to some kind of divinity school to become the Ayatollah, the kid never did. So they said, in a normal thing, if he just dies, there's no way this guy gets in charge. But if you do something and kill the guy, all of a sudden, if it's a national crisis, they will ignore the fact that he didn't go to divinity school, and they'll put him in charge, and you don't want that to happen. That is what this article said, and I don't, who knows who wrote it or whatever, but it sort of made sense to me. Now, what do we got? We got him in charge.
Well, but yeah, we don't think, at least the stuff I'm reading says, we don't think he's in charge.
Okay.
We think the Revolutionary Guard leadership is in charge.
It's hard to tell. But I mean, those two things, when this all happened, I'm like, why now? It looks like... You know,
yeah, I go back to my earlier take, which is this was driven by what looked like a golden opportunity. We had demonstrated, the Israelis had, and we had demonstrated that Iran couldn't defend itself if we decided to go in there with a major air attack, and that we could, by owning the skies, we could effectively begin to impose an unacceptable level of damage on their economy, and that we could, with our naval assets, strangle their exports. And we could, and we did. I think the willingness to do it, coupled with the cold feet that the Gulf states, and remember, I think this administration's ultimate goal is to try to set up some kind of a regional power base with the Gulf states, Israel, and the Saudis that will counterbalance Iran effectively.
I think Netanyahu's a huge problem with that. He wants to conquer the whole place.
He's not. No, I don't think so. He's not. To the extent that he's expanding their military influence, it's mainly for their own security.
Well,
but
the goal was to set up
some kind of regional system that would counter the craziness coming out of Tehran. And I think that it was ultimately, or is ultimately, the goal. We have an opportunity to effectively neuter a huge destabilizing influence in the region, and that was Iran. And so we took it.
I think Lou, and again, grade me on this. The guy was old. There had been there's a lot of people in Iran that don't like the group, right? It's in charge, like a real lot.
Let me cut to the chase. I reject the idea of a moderate Iranian leader in any sense that you and I understand.
My point is, it looked to me like the thing was, maybe I won't say breaking apart, because I think that would be a wrong statement. Cracks were starting to happen to those guys, and I'm wondering if we just would have let it alone, we might have achieved more than what we did.
I don't know.
Well, I don't either. But it's
still
a thought.
Still,
it's
and again, the vote.
How can you tell? How can you argue something that didn't happen?
The votes are still out on this.
Yeah.
I, as I said, I express my opinion. I don't like the MOU. I don't like the terms, but I think I understand what drove it. So,
what do you think of
Can we talk real quick just about the Soresby situation? Have you guys talked about the supplemental draft and what's happening?
That's been a big argument the last two nights wherever I've been. Can you answer one question for me? Because I've been working on this all week. When these kinds of things happen, And we heard our new guy Kevin Warsh talking about the money, you know, the monetary policy yesterday, and I was ready to reach for the barf bag, but I didn't. People are, you know, your buddy Rahm Emanuel, I'm sure it wasn't his quote when he said, "Never waste a good crisis." And have you looked? I know you don't because you got like a real job. If you looked at the numbers, like in other places like Japan versus here, I decided, Lou, to get away from the politics here in terms of, you know, you don't like Trump, you don't, in policy, and just went to another place where I don't think anybody can really bitch at my numbers here. Now, the conclusions, they certainly can. Look at the Japanese situation. And we've talked, you and I talked last week or the week before, how not only were they getting hit by the oil prices going up, which you, by the way, articulately talked about at the beginning of this show, that maybe that was an influence on this memorandum thing. Yet, you look at what's happened over there, Lou. They had to put money in the system, and they were selling U.S. treasuries so they could keep their yen under 160 to the dollar. Which, by the way, it's still over, I think. So that's kind of their panic point. And by putting money in the system, they have generated inflation over there, which they really haven't had for 30, 40 years. Now all of a sudden they do. And some other people are not happy about it. I mean, sake's been the same price, I think, over there. I've never been there but for years. Well, now if you look at, they have pumped in the 3 months of this war almost 2% into their money supply, which they've like never done on a yearly basis. And so they have, their stock market is like 10% higher than when this started, which you would think if you're on the fourth moon of Alpha Centauri saying, well, gee, if there's this crisis, the market will be down. It's not. It's up. It's up 10%. And then you look at who owns the stock. 9% is owned by the government, and 29% is owned by the big banks. And I'm sitting there going, they sure as hell didn't waste a good crisis. You would never dream that with all this, you know, crying and wringing of hands over there, how bad they're doing, that the market would be up 10%. They used the opportunity, just like we did here, to pour money in and to totally distance the top 5% from the rest of the population, just like we've done here for 30 years that I keep talking about. I mean, doesn't anybody get pissed off at this except for me? Or don't people see it? There's no monetarists left in the world or what?
Well, I think you've talked about this. You've talked about this since I've been coming on the show, which is now what, 15 years.
Yeah.
That the economic boom that we saw in the aughts and into the after the crisis of 2008, the economic boom that we saw benefited a particular class of people. And every one of those booms has. And so I guess I'm not surprised that the Japanese elites are just as adept at dodging these kinds of impacts as Western elites are.
But the price that other people have to pay. But, I mean, here we don't, well, I don't think, the government doesn't own 9% of the market, and the banks don't own 29%. That's one thing nice about our system. But over there, it's a boom for those guys. Good Lord.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to your question is, don't they get angry? At some point, I'm sure they will. But populism has never been a big thing in Japan because populism requires a certain amount of undignified conduct. At least that's my perception.
But look at how much people take it here. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah, but we're less dignified, and so our threshold of pain is lower, I think.
The only thing. Again, I want to talk about the thing you want to talk about. The only thing here, Lou, is when you see my opinion, I'm no psychologist, where's Dr. Markwin, is when you see people under stress for economic reasons, other stuff starts to pop out and you wonder why they're so angry. And I think a lot of the anger is that for 20 years people have not participated like they think, like on average in the economy, that people say that you should have. Everything's great, the market's up. Well, not exactly if you're not in the market. Oh, by the way, if you don't own a house. So I think you see this stress. I mean, last time I talked to Dr. Blade was, he said, I've never seen a level of stress. And he's, you know, he's a retired psychologist. But by the way, he's Army educated, Lou, Dartmouth. And he He said, I've never seen the level of stress. You see it everywhere. You see it in shootings. You see it in traffic stops. You see it in people flipping people off. The stress here, it's here. People just don't know where it's from. And I'll give you a real quick. Why the hell I do this to you? I don't know. But since January 2020, right before COVID, Trump was in office, and again, it didn't matter. Him and Biden, it was the same thing. Between January 2020 and April 2026, which we are now, or the last number, money supply is up 48%.
Wow.
People say that the consumer price index is up 28%, which is a fat lie, but people's average hourly earnings are only up 21%. So those three numbers, I think, would give any psychologist say, wait a minute, you got some problems going on in your country that nobody's talking about. Because those numbers are just, you can't even, I mean, the CPI that they admit to is 28%. And I'm going to say average wages are up 21, 22. But the real inflation is probably 40 to 45. So there's the stress level everywhere. I mean, Larissa, who really helps out on Wednesday, was saying that she thinks not only the K-shaped economy, which she's the one she's been talking about since she's been on the show, she goes, I think the bottom half of the top part of the K is starting to be in trouble. Even the family that's making the $150,000 a year, between the taxes and the insurance and the price of housing going up and the price of education, the price of cars, even they, there's no way they're buying the new car for the 16-year-old girl to go to school when the car is $80,000. Of course, they're not going to buy an $80,000 car for a kid, but she's thinking the stress level is moving up into people we think are quote comfortable, but really aren't anymore. I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about this guy. Is he going to get drafted?
Yeah, I think he's going to get drafted. And so, have you talked about the supplemental draft and how it works?
I was just going to ask you. I know it's like in baseball. I don't know how it is in football.
So the way this works, and for the uninitiated who aren't following sports, the Sorsby kid is a quarterback who was going to play at Texas Tech this year. It turns out he's got a huge gambling addiction in problem, including betting on his own team while he's a member of it.
Was he playing, or was he playing, or just, we don't know that.
We don't know if he played in games where he actually bet, but he was definitely a member of the team where he was betting. So I guess the potential was there for him to go in. He was suspended by the NCAA for gambling, and it was an immediate suspension for the upcoming season and maybe longer.
Well, how did they catch him?
I don't know how they caught him. The reports are now that Cincinnati, he started at Cincinnati, went to had been at Indiana for a week before what's his face took over. Cignetti took over. He left Indiana with the change of head coach, goes to Cincinnati, plays at Cincinnati, and then Texas Tech picks him up. The allegation is that when he was playing at Cincinnati, at the University of Cincinnati, they knew he was a gambling addict. They've denied that. But he arrives at Texas Tech.
Are we talking DraftKings or the local bookie? We don't know.
We're talking everything.
Okay.
Everything. He bet himself. He bet through friends. He bet through family members.
Was he making that much money?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, NIL, yeah.
Oh, he was, okay.
This stuff.
But what would you guess the number is? Was it seven figures?
What he was making in NIL, yeah, I would guess it was
really?
Over
okay.
a million.
That's a number, yeah.
So he leaves Cincinnati, goes to Texas Tech. God knows what their NIL payment to him was. And he gets to Texas Tech. The suspension kicks in. He sues, gets an injunction in state court.
Right,
so
Cincinnati snitched on him to the NCAA. Is that a fair statement?
It could happen. I have not seen a credible report as to how they found out.
Okay,
but in
somehow the NCAA suspended him.
Suspends him.
Okay,
he gets a court injunction, a state court injunction that prohibits the NCAA from enforcing its suspension. So it looks like he's going to play at Texas Tech. Texas Tech says, "Great."
Okay, but the reason for that was the hearing wasn't until after the season, correct?
Well, right. I mean, the appellate. Once he gets the injunction, the appellate procedure and everything else was gonna run starting in February of next year, which meant he would have played, and then it didn't matter. He would have entered the NFL draft at the end of this upcoming season. in the meantime, the rest of college football goes, you've got a guy betting on his own team, and we're going to have to play him. And this is, we're not willing to live with this precedent. And the real trigger, I think, for all of this was the Attorney General of Texas, a guy named Paxton, who I think is running for Senate now. But he, when this injunction goes in, several schools and major conferences said, we're not going to play this.
It was like Nebraska and somebody else, wasn't it?
Nebraska and Utah did it immediately. The Southeastern Conference, so the Texas Tech's a member of the Big 12, the Southeastern Conference said, whoa, time out. We're not going to schedule the, we're looking at not scheduling this team. And a lot of momentum was building to basically.
But this year's schedule was already set. So
this year's schedule was set, but there were definite rumblings by the conferences that they were going to force if any of their team members went against Texas Tech at football, they were going to forfeit. And so all of this stuff is roiling. Then the Attorney General of Texas comes in and sends out a letter saying, I am contemplating legal action against all of these conferences, you know, the SEC, the Big 12, anybody else that's got a team in Texas, to prohibit you from retaliating against Texas Tech if this kid plays. Well, that was too much. When that happened, the Big 12 filed lawsuit saying you can't dictate, you know, you may be able to control what goes on in the state of Texas, but you can't dictate what our member schools are going to do outside of the state of Texas. So they filed suit, and then the phone calls, I think, started going to the Texas Tech president and the AD saying, this is out of control. You could end up basically screwing schools throughout the state if you try to force this kid to play, or you let this kid play.
Did anybody actually say that, I'm Nebraska, we have a home game with you, don't show up and we'll eat the gate?
No. The immediate threat from Nebraska and Utah, I think, was no scheduling of Texas Tech in any sport.
After the kid's gone, what does that do?
Well, they would retaliate against the school, whether he's gone or not. Okay. It's going to be any sport. So
he's got 1 year of eligibility left. That's why the court said
so,
what they
so
said.
This was all boiling up, you know, and the pressure was put on Texas Tech, and they announced that they weren't going to play him this season to take the pressure off. Once they did that, the kid then said, okay, I'm out of here. You're not gonna play me, fine. Now, it may have been that they didn't anticipate what was going to happen once they got the kid's agent and Sorsby himself did not anticipate what was going to happen once they got the injunction, and once the injunction went in place that said you have to let him play, all the other stuff, you know, started boiling up. So the kid and his people went to Texas Tech and said, "Just don't say you're not going to play me. Once you say that, then I can enter the NFL supplemental draft." And I mean that would have been an effective resolution, and that's what they did. So they said, "Okay, we're not playing you." Sorsby says, "Fine, I'm withdrawing from Texas Tech. I'm entering the NFL supplemental draft, which is held."
Do you have any knowledge or any suspicion? Let's pick a number. Let's say he was going to get $1 million. Was a third of that from Texas Tech and two-thirds from some auto dealer? Are those contracts null and void? What do you think that's all about?
My understanding, I mean, there was a press release from Texas Tech that said they weren't going to ask for the money back.
What about, I don't, if it's lose law firm, you're not going to pay them, are you?
I wouldn't, but whatever NIL commitment they made, they said that they're not going to try to recoup the money.
Well, would you pay them in advance?
Some of it,
it's only June. He's not going to play till September.
Some of it, I suspect, was paid in advance.
So that brings up an interesting question. If the school's going to give your kid $500,000, does he get it in a check in June, or is it weekly, or what?
I think that's up to the individual schools. I haven't seen a standard policy on that.
Well, if Nike's giving him $1 million, maybe they'll just, I don't know if they're going to take the Nike sponsor to the NFL, but all right, so where, that's why I was dying to have you on today for a million other reasons, but where does, now the NFL has a strict rule against gambling, correct?
Yes, it does.
All right, so is the court now more powerful than the NFL? Because the NFL obviously thinks they're pretty powerful, but is this going to be, who decided that a gambling addiction is now like alcoholism? I mean, where did that come from?
Oh, that's always been in place.
Okay, that's what I mean. I don't know. That's why I asked.
So in 1967, that's been in place from the earliest days of the league. But when my father joined the NFL in 1967, the first or second day of training camp, the NFL security people came in and they sat with the entire team, the coaches, everybody, and said, you may not bet. You may not go to Vegas and gamble there. You may not bet, you know, overseas. You may not bet on a cruise ship outside the U.S. waters.
You couldn't even be seen in a casino, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And they also said you may not consort with known gamblers. And so it was an absolute prohibition. And then, as my father pointed out, he said, yeah, they give us the song and dance about not doing any of this stuff. And then 7 years later, he said, I turn on, you know, the NFL on CBS, and there's Jimmy the Greek talking to Brett Musburger about point spreads and you know, how many points he's giving on certain games. And I'm going, this is one of our principal vehicles for generating fan interest in the game, and we're not allowed to consort with known gamblers, but they are.
Well, you can, it's like the racehorse. You can bet on the racehorse. You don't want the racehorse betting.
That's right. And so anyway, the this kid's going to enter. This kid says, okay, I can't play. I'm going to enter the NFL supplemental draft. The supplemental draft is a incredibly convoluted process. I would think that if the NFL said, okay, we're going to have a secondary draft to catch kids who suddenly become eligible for this program, you know, after our regular draft in April. Okay.
These are like kids that could have turned 19 and are eligible even though they're not in school, that kind of thing?
Well, these are kids who were not eligible for the April draft for whatever reason, but suddenly are not going to be able to play college football this year or are rendered ineligible for collegiate football, who now will now offer an opportunity to play.
Well, what happens to a kid who comes out of high school? He might be a good football player, doesn't really get a scholarship, doesn't give a crap about school, is playing in one of these flag leagues now or touch leagues, and finally somebody notices him and says, hey, this kid's grown a little bit. He's pretty damn fast. Now, would that kid be in the supplemental draft?
No, typically not.
He can just go sign anywhere he wants.
He would go sign as a restricted free or an undrafted free agent. So you have to formally petition the NFL to request eligibility. If you were eligible or could have been signed in the regular April draft, you can't. You're not eligible. Once the NFL says, okay, we've got this Sorsby kid, he's ineligible to play college football next year. He's put his name in. We're going to let him go. He comes in. The league then breaks up teams for this draft process. You would think they would just go, okay, fine. Let's just take the regular draft order from April, and whoever wants to spend a draft pick on this kid in whatever level gets him. You know, we'll start with.
Does that count against the draft pick next year?
Yes, it does. We'll start with the Jets, and we'll go from there. You would think they would do that. They don't. What they do is they break up the league, the teams, into three tiers.
The first tier is a teams that wins that have won six or fewer games last year. Second tier is teams that won more than six games that didn't make the playoffs. And then the third tier is the 14 teams that qualified for the postseason. So each within these tiers, then, they hold a lottery that gives a draft order. So tier one has a draft order, tier two has a draft order, tier three has a draft order.
They made this more complicated?
It's crazy. So then, once you get the draft order set, then the bidding starts. And what you do is you submit a sealed bid that says, okay, we're gonna spend we think Sorsby is a second round pick, or alternatively, if we really want him, we're gonna make him a first round pick.
So you're the price you're bidding is your a position in next year's draft.
Yes.
So if it was, you know, it was Johnny Unitas, you'd immediately send a one in.
Right. If yeah. And so the teams in tier one go
first. How many kids are in this draft? Just out of curiosity.
It depends.
I mean, is it less than 10, more than 100?
No. This is typically done for a very, very limited number of players, and in some years, Tom, they don't hold the draft at all.
So let's say under 10. So if you're going to throw a 7 in, you might as well forget it.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It depends on your assessment of the player.
Okay.
How badly do you want him? I mean, if you're a tier one team with fewer than six wins, presumably you don't have a great quarterback. And so you would be interested in getting this kid. Is he worth somebody that you're looking at for next year? Is he going to be better than them? If he is, then you'll spend a draft pick.
Well, you also have to figure, what are the chances of him not coming out of rehab and betting to be disqualified right out of the gate?
Exactly.
Exactly. You don't want him to be a Johnny Manziel where every day 15 different news people show up.
No, that's right. And so you know, there's a lot of – you can only imagine what this kid's agent
– Well, how good do you think he is?
He's a legitimate – what I heard talking to people is that he's a legitimate second round. And he would probably go, if he had a good year, he would probably go in the high second round, maybe even low first round next year.
I'm going to say, I don't know if I want the kid. I mean, to me, it's a lot more hassle than it's worth, but that's just me. But now, if nobody wants him, then what? Is the NFL in trouble for essentially?
No, nobody. If he doesn't get selected in the supplemental draft, he becomes an undrafted what's called an undrafted free agent, and then he can sign with anybody.
Okay. Well, so I mean, but
somebody will take a chance on.
But how about Colin Kaepernick never got a chance, you know? I mean,
well, Kaepernick played and got hurt.
All right, I thought he didn't play at all after the incident. He did.
Well, sorry, he made himself radioactive, but before that he was playing, and you know, my impression on him was just that was just a talent issue. He I think he got hurt and then never really came back. But regardless, his talent level dropped off and teams didn't want him. And there was a circus issue with him, obviously, that you know, the off the field stuff created problems for him as well. But that's the case with a lot of players. That was the Tim Tebow problem.
Yeah. You know, Kevin said the stuff he's read, they're thinking a third-round talent, and that maybe somebody will offer like a fourth or, you know, he says fifth, something other than a third-round pick to get him.
I'm seeing the stuff I saw said he could go, if somebody really wanted him, they would project him in a low first-round pick. But that's, you know, that's the eyeball of whoever's doing the evaluation.
What happens if three teams put in a two?
Well, they bid in order, and so if three teams put in a two, they look at if there's a tying bid, he's awarded to whichever team holds the higher priority from the lottery order. So what happens is tier one, all the teams put in their bids. You open up the bids, the highest draft number gets him. If two teams put the same draft number on him, then they look at the ranking order within the tier and say, okay, the lowest ranked team gets him.
They used to say at Pullman that a camel was a horse designed by committee. Was this process designed by committee? Good Lord.
I don't understand why they did it this way. It like I said, I would just have proceeded giving people a crack at the kid in the draft order that was in place in April. But that, you know, they apparently wanted to make a system that would give everybody or give people a shot regardless of what the record was.
So the NFL appears to have no residual that if a kid gambled all the way through college, they're fine with it, and he's going to come in here and not gamble again. I mean, what? Well, how does that all work?
Well, there's no league prohibition on that, because the gambling or the drug use or the criminal conduct, whatever it was, took place before the kid was a member of the league. Once he enters the league, he's subject to league rules. But prior, and actually, once he enters the draft, once he becomes draft eligible, he's been drafted. He's subject to league rules. But no, there's no requirement.
Does anybody think the kids actually stop gambling?
I don't know. He's gotten through rehab.
Oh God. So did Schuster, and so did Denny McClain.
That's right. I mean, I think the Kevin's take is correct with respect to where the ultimate number is. I think the combination of whatever his talent is, and apparently he's quite talented, whatever his talent is, mitigated by the risk that he's still a gambler and an addict, I think the combination of those two factors probably puts him in the 3-4 round pick.
Okay.
Because he's a risk.
Yeah, I mean, it's so bizarre. I mean, the idea of, you know, where the courts fit in, where these leagues think they are. They think they're above courts, I think, some of them.
Well, the NFL, let's say the kid comes in, he gets drafted, he goes to a team, he gambles. The league says you're suspended. The kid runs to some Texas state court judge again and says, I need an injunction to stop them from doing this. The court, at that point, is going to say something entirely different than it said to him when he was a college student. They're going to say, I'm sorry, young man, you are a union member. There is a union grievance procedure in place for exactly this kind of issue, and I don't have jurisdiction. The only place you can complain is the National Labor Relations Board. And that's where this goes.
What happens for
this kind of thing?
Is he... Nowhere in this picture, other than the suspension, nowhere did the state of Ohio somehow file charges saying he bet against his own team and went out there and threw three interceptions. I mean, there's nothing like that. There's no criminal case against him or state civil case or anything like that.
No, there could be a criminal case against him because he gambled underage. But no, there's nothing like that in the record right now.
Since I've never done it, and I'm not accusing you of doing it, I don't know, Ricky, if you know, tell us. If I sign up for DraftKings, do they just say, are you over 21, or do they want to see my driver's license, or are they rigorous about this at all?
No, we asked this question last time. They just say, sir, you tell us you're over 21. Are you over 21? Yes, I am. Okay, here's the website.
If they find... That's interesting. I know some casinos. Well, this is back when I used to like to go to casinos. I was never a big gambler, although I would only gamble if I thought I had a little bit of an edge, sort of like my trading. So I like to play blackjack because I counted cards enough and knew the rules enough where I thought I at least had a fair chance. You know, I never thought I was good enough to win or anything like that, but at least I could defend myself. And, you know, you see I did hear tell one night I was in a casino in Vegas that somebody walked in and won a bunch of dough and a slot machine, and were the point where it was enough where he had to go out and pay the kid. Well, then they carded him, and he wasn't 21, and they wouldn't give him the dough. But as long as he was putting money in and not winning, they didn't card him.
No. Well, I mean, I think that's probably, that certainly could happen, I think.
You're only carded if you win. As long as you're losing, it's okay with us.
That's right. Well, that's when we check.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, if he gets into the NFL and does this again, the NFL's disciplinary process will kick in. And that's a collectively bargained process. And theoretically, you can challenge an employment decision in federal court if in fact it violates one of the federal discrimination laws or something like that. But or a wage and hour law or something like that. But that's not going to be, I mean, he might be able to try to raise that and say, look, I'm an addict. They have to accommodate this under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the league's going to say, yeah, save it for the National Labor Relations Board. And I think most courts would
what
say
happens,
that.
What happens if the NFL, which I think they've sort of done before in people, I think they might have done that in that Maurice Claret kid, but what if nobody drafts him?
Okay. And he signs or doesn't sign?
Well, I mean, and then he, whenever every place he goes afterwards, say we don't want you. Then what?
Okay. Well, I mean, if he could show it's the result of some bias that is actionable, he could theoretically sue. But you know, these kinds of decisions are effectively unreviewable because the burden of proof on establishing something other than you're too much trouble, we don't think you'd be a good football player for our team, it's such a subjective and legitimate factor that you might find a lawyer to take the case. I kind of
you can
doubt.
Only imagine if the Bears signed him the first day, of course it may only last a day. Ever since you went into rehab, have you made any bets? Those kinds of questions got to be piling out, don't you think?
Oh yeah, and their security team is going to be looking at this as well.
How many people do you think are in this gambling craziness? Actually, the people, there was a couple lived downstairs from Water years ago. I mean, they were old then, and I think they both about to be dead. But the guy ended up going through, and he had the nice wife. They had the couple. He was a blue collar worker, and all of a sudden he leaves. And she finds out the banks have been drained, and he's been gambling at the casino when he went home from work every day.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think it's a real problem, and I think especially for over-hormoned young men with poor impulse control. Hello?
Yeah.
Anybody recognize people there?
Yeah.
I think it's a real issue.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen it in a while, but Aud and I, we have our places we go on Saturday night, right? And one of them is, well, they all got them now, but Pepe's is one of the first places that had the games. You know, whenever we go, imagine that, me talking to everybody. So I'm talking to the bartender, and I go, what's the deal with those games? He goes, yeah, we're doing pretty good on them. He goes, I got a little problem with it. And I go, why is that? And he goes, one of our nicest waitresses, she works her fanny off basically to make $120, and way out every night she blows 50 in the machine. And he goes, I just shake my head, or nothing I can do. I said, but I just shake my head going, doesn't she know the odds? What's the matter with her? I mean, two weeks ago I was in the gas. You know the scratch-off lotteries now? The highest one used to be $35, now they're 50. You can get a 50 scratch off if you want. This guy comes in, he goes, yeah, give me a 50 235s, and whatever it totaled up, he ended up with like six tickets. It was $250. This is 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I mean, really?
You can burn through a lot of money that way.
Yeah, and the states seem to love it, and they don't realize that it's amazing. I mean, you know, we talk a lot on the show, you and I and everybody, about somehow, I won't say it's the stupidity of people, because I don't think there is such thing as a stupid human being, but you can be very dumb in certain areas, and you don't realize that this gambling is, when somebody comes out and says, hey, we're going to have a casino, and everybody goes, great, or there's going to be betting on Major League Baseball or football, great. Well, the politician who's telling you that, you think, if you're, like you say, if your T level's too high and you're 25 years old, you're going to beat these guys. You know more about the NFL than the rest of the world, so you're going to win. The state doesn't care. All they know is every time somebody bets, somebody gets 10%, right? You bet 110 to win 100.
I'll leave you with this. The state knows that there are all these undesirable consequences from this, and they do it anyway.
Yeah.
They do it anyway. Same with the legalization of marijuana, where we're finding out here in Colorado. And on that note, I'm going to leave you and wish everybody a good weekend.
How about you take care of yourself? SP Futures up 51, NASDAQ Futures up 412. We're above where we were down in the NASDAQ yesterday, but we're not. We're down 85 in the S&P, so we're, you know, two-thirds. We got a Fibonacci replacement. We have our guys?
Yeah, you've got me here.
Are you do you have a Fibonacci beard now? You look like Fibonacci?
No, I my beard. Sometimes I'm have it in good mind to just shave it off. But you know, living in Florida, you know, being a fan of Ernest Hemingway, you know, I go with the look.
Welcome all those old dudes like Leonardo and Fibonacci and all those guys. They all had the long hair and the big beard. I mean, was that the look if you were smart?
Yeah, I think you had to look like an intellectual, so you weren't hauled before, you know, some local princes or duke's court and charged with intellectualism without the appearance,
without a license.
Yeah, without a license. Yeah, you know. It's a shame that there's no one in the White House that ever took a history class, because do they not realize that Versailles doesn't have a very good track record when it comes to peace peace agreements?
That's did you ever, I think you have, I mean, I'm sure you've read various you know, opinions about the Versailles. Well, the one that I thought the most for me was the one from William Kennedy and Freedom from Fear. Did you read that book?
Yeah.
But I had no idea that when they got up from the table, 95% of all the world's known oil resources were on one side of the table.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I've heard about it in college and high school and places, but I never realized it was that much of a thing. And I haven't mentioned this kind of in a while, but it ended up being, did you ever hear, I don't know if we have Andrew, if he does, he just popped right in, but did you ever hear those, of these bonds that were, they were bearer bonds that other countries have essentially given out. Some of them were gold-backed, some weren't. And then as soon as they changed, you know, leadership, the bonds are no good. There's Maximilian bonds from Mexico. There's Santa Ana bonds. And there were a lot of bonds from Germany during...
Yeah, there were, wasn't the Baden-Württemberg bonds or something, but they were all... They all became worthless later on.
Well, sort of, because I was kind of with some people who had some of these, and they asked me to try and find, you know, if they were worth anything, which I of course knew they weren't, but I wasn't all that busy at the time, and figured if I dig into this, I was like you two guys, if I dig into this, I'm going to meet some of the weirdest people that I've ever met, and sure enough, I did, because there were people who thought that even though the bond was worthless, sometimes you could use it as a collateral for like a water treatment project in Yemen or something, that the bond would be considered collateral and then you could get a loan with it. But the weird part was some of them were gold backed bonds with the gold in a bank in Germany, but they were issued by a company, and you know, the companies over there were all real tight with the you know, the government. This is before Hitler, and they were sold in this country, which they weren't. They were kind of approved by not the SEC, by whoever was the previous to the SEC. They didn't have a, you know, CUSIP number, but the circle bleep was that Germany was paying reparations to France and Britain, and so they're giving them money. France and Britain, we were demanding payments of our World War I debt, unlike the World War II stuff, right? So we were actually getting money from those guys on a, you know, monthly basis or something. they didn't have the dough either. So the German people are selling bonds here to American people that are sending cash to Germany, which is then going to France and Britain and coming back to our government. Andrew, even you couldn't write a book that this... How could this... And then Hitler comes in and says, we're not paying off on any of that stuff, even though the companies still exist, and oh, by the way, the banks still exist. So if there ever was any gold, who knows, the Nazi guys probably stole it. If there ever was any gold, it theoretically would still be sitting there. I mean, I went through this, and I'm going, you guys got to be kidding. But it was an amazing education in just another sordid tale in human events.
Just like, well, good morning. Yeah. If I could pop in with a thought there, because you've prompted, as you implied, a number of kind of researches I've gone through the curiosity route. But here's a current application. To dig into this stuff makes me, at least, appreciate that we have institutions that we often take for granted that provide a normality to our concepts. But it didn't always used to be like that. And at one point, I was researching how there is one of our religions in its early days, they'd issue their own currency here in the U.S. in the Ohio region. And they'd get the members of the religion to use it as money. And other people didn't accept it, but the people in the religion, because it was basically issued by their church, they used it, but it doesn't end well.
Well, didn't you guys, I don't know if you ever fans it, some of the subtleties, did you ever watch the show Bonanza? I mean, everybody did back in the day. Hoss Cartwright and Ben Cartwright and that group.
Little Joe.
When you went to the, I think, the Virginia City Bank, because the background of the story was Virginia City basically sat on, the Conestock Lode or something, so it was a silver mine. So there was all that stuff going on, and then they had the big... But the deal, I think, the Virginia City Bank and those banks in those days, didn't they issue their own scrip?
Oh, yeah. It was quite later on that the U.S. adopted a federal currency. I know during the early part of the country, you had individual banks issuing their own currency. I know the banks in Philadelphia did that, for example. I remember as a kid we went through the U.S. Mint on a field trip in Philadelphia, and they actually were displaying some of this early bank issued currency. The lesson there is we can never go back to that system again. So appreciate what we do here at the Mint.
Well, I seem to remember that it's been a long, long time ago, that whenever Little Joe or somebody got to go to San Francisco, they always went to the bank and got like $50 gold pieces, because the Virginia City stuff, I don't think, played well in San Francisco. Right.
Yeah.
But that's the only time you... Go ahead, Andrew.
I was just going to say another implication of that is, how do you move the money around? And so on a visit to Connecticut, I visited somebody who... their office for their business was a former U.S. Postal facility. And he said, would you like to have a tour? And I said, sure. They closed down the post office, so it's a, 130-year-old building. And he said, there's an amazing thing that most people wouldn't know about, which is they had all kinds of secret passageways so postal inspectors could see if the mail sorters were stealing money, like silver and gold, from the envelopes. And I said, what? And we go up, and there's a whole separate entrance where the postal inspectors could come into this building without the postal workers knowing it, and walk above them and peer down on the mail sorting facilities, and they could even look into the bathrooms, both men and women's.
Oh, God.
See if they were... Because think about it, to take your Oscar Cartwright story here, you know, at some point, people might be mailing money to each other.
I think when I was a little kid, we mailed quarters a couple of times.
Well, we're talking. Yeah. I'm talking about gold.
Yeah.
And people weren't paid that much. And so the flip side of having a gold and silver-backed currency is people might steal it. And
well, yeah. And,
so I had a very interesting historical tour walking along these little catwalks, thinking, boy, that was a different society when everybody had to worry about their gold doubloons being stolen from the mail.
Well, there are a couple of things today. We talked a lot with Lou. I want to get into this Iran thing. Lou, as usual, gave a, I don't know if you guys are listening, an amazingly articulate, I thought, think about all the different levels of pressure that was probably put on from people as to where this is coming. Plus, this is becoming so commonplace that I don't even think people react. If you walk down the street every morning and somebody guy comes out and kicks you right in the ass, how many days before you figure that's just a normal walk to work? And you don't even complain about it. I mean, the headline here, Intel surges 9% after Trump says company will part with Apple. And is that in the executive branch of the Constitution, is that the president's job now to maybe buy stock beforehand and announce some kind of a deal like that?
Well, I think that's what he's been doing all along with this Strait of Hormuz. Is it closed? Is it open? Maybe not, excuse me, so much Trump, but, you know, his kids are master manipulators. The other people around him are master manipulators, Letnik and these others. And I think they're just creating their own news environments and echo chambers to play the market, play the currencies, play everything.
Well, I mean, it was kind of on two levels here, if you don't mind. One is just the normal front running of the market, which I think has been beyond ridiculousness. With those guys come out with I see the market move, and then 10 minutes later, I get the announcement: the Strait's closed, it's open. You know, whatever kind of BS. But this idea, and maybe, well, and Andrew, take this one, the idea that you're involved in picking winning companies is a totally different level of the chessboard than what you and I are just talking about, Wayne. I mean, the idea yeah. that, I mean, I'm talking about this Intel before Trump, you know, his big bazoo got in there, you know, 330.26, stock was $41. Now it's 132. And they've done nothing but, you know, push deal after deal against to these people. It's totally been a government rally for this stock. Now, you know, they might have done some stuff on their own and those kinds of things, but this is going on now. Now, what if you're a competitor of Intel? And you're not... I mean, this is not something... I'm not going to be dumb enough to say that government was never involved in some businesses here when you look at, you know, the industrial, was the military-industrial establishment and those kinds of things, but the idea that you're picking winners of just any other industry right now, you're deciding this, you know, this auto company is going to get this. I mean, and you're announcing it. I don't think I ever heard Eisenhower or Kennedy or any of those guys mention the name of an individual company. Did you?
Jimmy Carter, you know,
same thing.
His peanut farm had to be put into a blind trust because he was so concerned about the potential conflict of interests.
I mean, how did our entire morality just run with it? And How do you bring that back? I mean, is it ever possible? Can you? This is right up Andrew's alley. Once people decide it's okay to kick everybody in the ass once when they walk from the train to the office, how do you come back and say no, it's not?
Well, here's I can report that I just heard I wouldn't call it a program, but a an activist, a political organizer, last night deliver a weekly overview to his flock, and I listened to him, and he said, we've got to restore virtue, real virtue, to political life. And he said, if you look at these candidates, his name is Simon Rosenberg, not to obscure it, but he says, if you look at a wave of candidates who are stepping forward to run for Congress and governorships, with some exceptions, they have backgrounds in the military, and elsewhere, that are impressive. And we've got to get virtue back there, because the public doesn't believe in promises or what people say, but if they look at someone and think, oh, they've been a religious leader or a military leader or something like that, we got time to pay attention to that, not words that people are making. So I think that might be an answer, but obviously it's a process, even if it works. And having seen that the person who just won a primary for Congress this week in Oklahoma was just, he had to drop out because the Daily Mail revealed all his comments to some staffer, and it became a sex scandal, and he was a pastor. So it's not foolproof, but people are thinking about it.
It seems to me that a lot of the, well, you don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but it's becoming so pervasive that I don't think a lot of people even think it's wrong. I often wonder what happened to like a guy like Biden. I don't know him anywhere near as much like you guys would know him, but it looks to me like he's kind of a jamoke from Delaware. He's a representative. He works his way up. He's there for a long time, taking the train home back and forth, and then all of a sudden when his wife got killed or whatever. And at some point, I think somebody said to him, do you realize how much money all these other people are making here, and you're sitting here like a mope sitting on the train? It's at some point, I wonder if you're... this stuff is swirling around you that you feel like you're an idiot not by putting your hand in the till. Unless you're ridiculously wealthy on your own, which we've seen that at different levels in the show for a while now. Carl talked about his friend that he's a Republican in Florida. His buddy ran for the House, and how he got the party wanted his cell phone and blah blah blah. Or else, and if you didn't play ball, you weren't going to get a committee. And after either one or two terms, the guy couldn't wait to get out of there. It seems like there's at some level, when you're there long enough, where you say, "Okay, I'll play ball," and then you get to stay and you get to have some power, with the anchors that the money you're getting from people gives you on the power. And it seems like that's kind of where we are, where you're out of the 435 people in the House, really only 35 of them mean anything, and the other 40 might as well stay home. It's not just one level, Andrew. And I think it's on all these different levels that we try and talk about, and then we always forget about another level. Is it, or where am I wrong here?
Well,
I would just say I remember covering Congress back in the 90s, there was a different level of what you're talking about. With, hey, I got a nice little arrangement over here. We all remember Dan Rostenkowski.
Yep.
With the House Post Office and what went on there. And then there was a Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, over advances for books. Now, the book advances were always kind of looked at, but not, they weren't considered a huge ethical issue. Newt Gingrich got caught up in that whole ethics issue, but both parties were doing it. But now, we're at a level where what you've been talking about, Chief, that, you know, that owning all this stock and having an interest in formulating policy that's going to benefit your own portfolios. I don't think we saw that kind of corruption. The corruption that I saw in the 90s and everybody saw and reported on it was kind of the in-house stuff, which, yeah, was considered bad at the time, but now it's like, discovering that somebody's paying penny poker games, and you know, I mean, it's so much different in comparison.
Let me give a couple, two brief examples. At one point, there was a U.S. let me think, senator or congressman from Maine, Orrin Brewster, that if any of the listeners can remember, Jack Anderson. Well, Anderson and Pearson, his senior writing colleague, did about 80 columns about this guy, Orrin Brewster from Maine, when he was sleeping in a Pullman car. That's why I wanted to get this in, Chief. Lost $5,000. Somebody came and grabbed his wallet and took $5,000. And they did 80 or 90 stories about this. And the young Jack Anderson said, gee, we're really hammering this guy over $5,000. Isn't it enough that he lost, somebody stole his money in the Pullman car? And the senior writer, Pearson, said, look, the guy was playing cards with lobbyists that night. Do you think he loses? He says, to our readers, $5,000, this is like 1951 or something, that's huge. They need to know that their guy plays cards with lobbyists.
Well, Andrew, I'm gonna take a shot and go back to your South Side morality. Which, at what point? I mean, just the regular person, and you can see it in our industry. I mean, PTI is not that big, and we've got the South Side mentality. We got our job to do. We help people and blah blah blah, and we charge commissions. And every once in a while, you know, you might have a client who might come in through the electronic or wherever they come in from, and they are kind of messing up, and all of a sudden you'll hear somebody here. We don't have that many people, so we'll talk to them and we'll say, here's your position, this kind of problem, look at your risk and so forth, and all of a sudden maybe they pay attention to you, maybe they don't. Say they do, and all of a sudden your advice might cause somebody to not lose 50 grand if they're big trading big, or 100 grand, and your commission's 10 bucks. You know, at some point, we don't, because we just, you know, that's not the way we think. Maybe we should. But if I'm a representative or I'm a senator, and the money in the world, with, you know, we keep talking about money supply going up and everything, the money is getting so big that I almost to the point where if Trump administration puts together some kind of a deal, and they, you know, and there are big deals going down, and all of a sudden Intel is favored, and all of a sudden everybody owns Intel stock, doubles their money, and you're sitting there, either your representative making 100 grand a year, or you're the president, you might say, where's mine? You might, wouldn't, I mean, it's not like it's that unnatural. I mean, the amount of, I mean, you know, it's like people expecting aldermen to be honest when every deal an alderman does is worth $1 million to somebody. I mean, I'm going to, you know, even Eddie Burke. Hey, I helped you out with this, you know, I got you ahead of everybody else in line, which maybe you shouldn't be able to do, or probably shouldn't be able to do, to get this permanent 6 months in advance. That gave you, you know, $2 million head start on your neighbor. But could you at least maybe, no, he went too far. But you can you at least talk to my law firm about maybe taxes and see if they're as good as anybody else? Hey, up yours. Screw you. Why do people keep asking people for stuff, and they don't expect to give anything back? You know what I mean? And I got to believe that after 20 years in Congress, somebody like a Biden, and I'm not making excuses for that, has got to be getting an idea of all these favors he's done for people, how well they're doing, and he's not. Right? I mean,
but you've zeroed in on Biden, and
I just used him as an example.
Fair. You know. No, you want to be fair both sides. Where, in point of fact, what his problem was, as near as I can tell, and I've looked at this for a while, it's it tends to be a more traditional thing. So, for example, his brother is kind of a lobbyist. He gets on boards, and his son was a drug addict who was a high flyer. But the scale of what we're talking about with him and his family is vastly less than what we see all the time with the Trump family. It's not equivalent. Look at this.
Oh, I never said it was.
USC extravaganza. They build this whole production. It's crypto. The Trump family is heavily involved in the promotions, and it's at a scale, you know, that dwarfs what I was talking about, the postal worker
I'm 100% with you on the scale. I'm just saying, if you were the honest person, an honest alderman, if there is such a thing, if you were an honest alderman, the numbers have gotten so big that you greasing the wheels, legally or not, say legally, for a business, and all of a sudden the guy you just did it for next year makes 20. The numbers that Intel is going to make on this stuff, the stuff that NVIDIA is going to make, they're so far beyond the comprehension, certainly of me, and I think I have a better view of numbers than most people in the country. Why my representative's a crook because he got, you know, Joe Schmo's tank company just bought 3 tickets for his campaign thing at $100 a piece. And you say, wait a minute, he just helped Joe Schmo's tank company get a contract that's worth $50 billion. I mean, I think the amount of stuff, I mean, I'm wandering here a little bit, but I think you know where I'm coming from. You talk about a presidential campaign now is, let's say, $1 billion. There's got to be 100 companies.
Well, far more than that.
Okay,
far more.
Right, roll with me for a second. There's got to be 50 companies in this country would gladly write that check because the amount of money government's given out now. I think people have kind of lost track of just how much government is doing for people in terms of who's the winner and the losers.
Well, direct intervention in the market. I know we're coming up on break, but look at Don Jr. is and Eric Trump, they're involved in Don Jr. drone manufacturing. You know, did he get in there because he knows how to make drones? No, it's because of the war. And the amount of money that they're making is beyond belief. Of course, if the war ends, maybe it's not a great deal all around. But what it comes down to is this virtue where people, at least in my view, need to think, okay, just because somebody else is getting rich, I don't need to go there because...
I'm with you. I just want to think about this when we go to break. Somebody asked George Stigler, Nobel Prize winner, a question. He was a behavioral economist, not like Milton Friedman and some of the other guys, and he's been to government policies. And the kid asked him, he says, how can you stop corruption in Chicago? He goes, I could stop it in a second. And he goes, how the hell are you going to do that? He goes, well, the mayor makes, at the time, $25,000 or something. He goes, the head of General Motors makes $250,000. The mayor's got a bigger budget, and he's got more people. Because the aldermen make $10,000 a year because you know they're stealing. And oh, by the way, you're pissed at them because they're stealing. Okay, you can't have it both ways. He said, if you paid at that time, he said, if you paid an alderman $500,000 a year and put $400,000 of it into escrow, and every year afterward that they weren't a crook, they keep getting paid, I could stop it tomorrow. You can't put somebody in a job that directs money so much more than they are making, and then expect them not to get a piece along the way when they know how much they're worth to somebody. And somewhere along the line, there's going to be, if somebody offers them $10,000 and they're making $10,000, I mean, because there's, you know what you're going to get. If you pay somebody $10 because they're stealing, they're going to steal, right? I mean, I'm not saying the idea, I don't think it would apply to what you were talking about. The idea that the President of the United States makes $400,000 a year is absurd, right? What should you make for that job?
Except that, I know we're on break, but let's maybe we can address it afterwards.
Yeah.
But it's more nuanced now because Trump, for example, brags that he doesn't take his salary, but if he's making literally billions a year, billions with a B, who cares whether he's taking $50,000 salary?
But I'm more toward over break. Let's think about how would we set the Chicago alderman up where he makes enough and is not incented to do this stuff. I mean, because right now, the people he deals with are all making 10 times what he's making, or 100 times.
Which, prosecute him. Well, grand jury and prosecute him.
SP Futures, SP Futures, he's a harsh man, your friend Andrew Wayne. SP Futures up 62. SP Futures up 461. By the way, I'm with you on that. I'd just rather see it happen less. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howe. Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 62. We're getting up there in the futures on the S&Ps. We were down 80 yesterday. NASDAQ up 455. We were only down 351 yesterday. So they're ahead of the game already. Over in Europe, let's see. This is kind of interesting. We sold off on the new Fed chair. And once we get done with how we're going to pay off Alderman with Andrew and Wayne, we're going to talk about this new Fed chair. DAX up 45. That's 0.2%. Not much. FTSE down 91. That's 0.9%. They kept their rates even. I don't know if people thought they were going to cut, but the FTSE Bank of England kept their rates even, and the FTSE doesn't seem to like it all that much. CAC round up 3, call that flat. Over in Asia, and these guys kneecap another $1,500 or $1,100, $1,150, 1.6%, 71,053. So they're like 13,000 higher than when the war started. Anybody doesn't think that the stock movement is a monetary event, at least in the short term, I don't know what tea leaves you're reading. Hang Seng down 387. It's 1.6%. Shanghai down 17.4%. Intel is leading the stuff here higher, obviously. I've got Intel is up. Where the hell is it? I got it here someplace. It's up 1082. It's up almost 9%. Stocks never made 9% moves unless they were being taken over back when I started this business, but now they do all the time. 10-year rate 4.44, down 2 basis points. We've got oil. I think still on the way down. It's down $1.75, 75.04. That's a long way from the high, which is like around 115, I think. RBOB, 290. So again, add the buck to that. You should be paying 390 or give or take 20 cents. Except if you're in downtown Chicago, you're still paying 550. Gold, down $99, 42.82. We don't like no stinking gold today. We're not sure why. Silver down 350, 67.25. Foreign exchange. We're at 114.69, so the dollar is at a one-year high on Fed hike bets because the Fed said they, half the people on the Fed said they're going to hike this year. British pound 132. We haven't seen it down that low in a long time. And Japan is almost 161, so they're still in their kind of their panic stage, which is supposed to be bad for them, except the market goes up every day. Crypto, a lot of conflicting stuff here. Bitcoin down 201, 64, 163. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at 65 degrees right now with a high of 71. Breezy this morning. Clouds and some glimpses of blue sky today with a shower in places. Phoenix, Arizona, 83 degrees right now with a high of 107. Very warm with gleaming sunshine. Tonight will be clear with a low of 82 degrees. Traffic in Chicago. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe. We're looking at 25 minutes. 38 minutes inbound Edens from Lake Cook. Eisenhower from Wolf is 30 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th is 27 minutes. And lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is 31 minutes. Leslie Sports, for the MLB, Cubs beat Rockies yesterday 8-6, but White Sox lost to Yankees 10-5. Last night we also saw Diamondbacks beating Angels 8-14, and today we got White Sox and Yankees at 6:05 p.m. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back over to you.
I want to talk to you guys a little bit about the new Fed chair, but this is, I mean, Andrew Wayne, if we decided to redesign government salaries and payments to minimize some of this, I think we would do, you know, a lot different than is being done right now. I mean, somehow or another, the amount of money that people shove around is so huge in relation to what they make. I think it's a part of the problem. It's still not going to make somebody who's moral not moral the other way around, but yet, I mean, incentives mean a lot, I think. You know, I don't know if you agree with me on that at all, but...
No, I do, but I don't think it needs to be complicated, really, because if we look to commissions to redesign local and government, local and state and federal, it'll never be anywhere. Whereas there's a few simple fixes. One, no trading by at least federal officials that have the ability to affect markets. Enforcement, punishment, make sure that people can't hide family income by saying, oh, well, it's my wife or son, it's not me, and figure out ways to close that loophole. And prison time for the miscreants instead of this world of pardons for your pals and even after they're convicted. This is not complicated, and those of us, you know, it wasn't a perfect system years ago by any means, but I've told this story before, but I'll keep it brief. But, you know, when I was a reporter, you know, I heard that a VA state leader was using workmen to build a doghouse in his yard, and I contacted the guy, and he didn't want to talk to me, but I wrote the story with a no comment, and he went before a federal grand jury within a month and was suspended and lost his job for having people build a doghouse in his yard when they were federal employees. This, within our lifetimes, we know it can happen, but people, it's not complicated.
It's also, but it's so easy to go after the low hanging fruit. I told you about the guy, the policeman who was taking money instead of giving people traffic tickets. He's got 50 months in jail. I mean, compared to what we're talking about, 50 months, isn't that kind of a while?
Yeah, I see a new generation. Especially in the Democratic Party now, the guy running for the U.S. Senate, Tallarico in Texas, his platform is absolutely to get rid of all this graft and corruption. And you know, after a lot of dodgy mayors in New York, Mamdani is actually being lauded, including by some Republicans, for not being the nightmare that they tried to say was going to be. That it's not only responsive government, but so far it's fairly clean government. So I hate to say this about my own baby boomer generation, but the graft and the corruption is there. And if this new, whatever you want to call them, Gen X, millennials, whatever, are going to go for cleaner government, maybe what we're talking about is going to happen, but it's not going to happen right away, but maybe you know, 20 years from now.
Well, I want to get onto this new Fed guy, but I'm looking here. If you were to say U.S. representative, all right, well, he's got to have two houses unless he wants to be the guy from Wisconsin and sleep in his office and head down to the locker room to use the bathroom and shower. I guess he's got a bathroom in his office, I hope. You can do that. Oh, by the way, it's going to cost him every 2 years, I'll pick a number, $800,000 to get elected. He's got to go back and forth if he wants to see his family. Let's pay him $174,000. And oh, by the way, while he's there, he's part and parcel of a bunch of people who give out $22 trillion in largesse. I mean, you just look at that and you go, really? I mean, I'm not asking anybody, and I'm like Andrew, I'm not making everybody be immoral. But then if you say only trust funders can run, we don't want that either, right? I mean, we want kind of regular people. But somewhere, someplace, we have to match this up. Otherwise, if you're a judge running in Illinois, and now you got to pay for your own campaign, well, the job pays $140,000, maybe $150,000, and oh, by the way, it costs you $700,000 or $500,000 to run a judge campaign. And if State Farm, Andrew, we've talked about this before, State Farm sends him a check for $250,000, and someday he gets a big personal injuries case from State Farm, what exactly did they buy? Well, we don't want him buying anything, do we? But we clearly have set the system up where he's going to get bought by somebody, isn't he?
Well, yeah, but the taxpayers can never afford to pay people in public office what they could make as CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company. So it has to be a variety of control mechanisms, of which law enforcement, public shame are component parts. Again, it's not a foolproof system, but you increase the punishment rate from half of 1% to, let's say, 10%, and that's going to send a message to people.
Oh, because sure, look, I agree.
And that's doable, but we also have to have an informed look at what are the obstacles. Now, one of the obstacles that I paid attention to that's very frustrating is the Supreme Court and other courts, but particularly the Supreme Court, have kind of gutted the bribery laws. And so despite all of the robes and pretensions to law and morality, they've made it in recent years very hard to mount a prosecution of officials for bribery. And you think, gee, is this legal? Why is this? And you could kind of sort through the legal reasoning and, you know, and that's one way to address it. Another way is saying, well, they really don't seem to care about bribery. Why is that? And then you look at how some of them are making their money on the side or through their relatives, and you say, bingo, we need, if we're going to have virtue in office, part of it's got to be looking at these Supreme Court justices and how are their spouses and children making money.
How much we pay those guys?
Well, it's John Roberts' wife has been making seven figures her business.
I understand
that. You know what her business is? It's headhunting for. Yeah. Elite law firms to recommend which are the former Supreme Court law clerks that are well regarded by the existing members of the court. And that's a version of insider trading, because she would know from her husband, the Chief Justice, exactly who the clerks are who are well liked, who are probably including his former clerks. for the most part, and she's making headhunter fees that amount to millions of dollars. And so there's these kind of rackets where, you know, they're very righteous looking. I see a bunch of them going to the Red Mass every September here in Washington, where great professions of morality. By the way, she's typically the honorary head, the Chief Justice's wife, of the John Carroll Society that puts on the Red Mass first Monday of October in St. Matthew's Church here in D.C. But somebody's just got to say, no, no more of this.
Okay, but how do you, Wayne, what do you think, what kind of security would we have to get our friend Andrew if he were going to push some rules that said, if you're in office, your wife can't work? What do you think? What do you think the women?
No, she can work. It's just got to be reported, and amplified, and not, oh, that's completely separate. The little woman. By the way, Lyndon Johnson initiated this in many ways because he had He had most notably a radio station down in Texas. And he said, "Wow, that's Lady Bird's operation." But he was muscling the FCC to give them more wattage and advertisers and
Lady Bird had the money, right? Not him.
Oh yeah. One thing about Andy is I know this for a fact. He does not have to cross any major thoroughfare on his way to the press club.
Because otherwise, I mean, I go back. I met this guy, my buddy Doc. You know, we used to have these people come to the, I mean, you meet all these guys, it's rare for me. And we met Phil Graham. Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Well, his wife, he came and spoke to us one day. His wife was Wendy Graham, who was on the board of Enron, and she was in charge of, help me here, what's the committee where you're supposed to make sure everybody's honest?
The ethics?
Yeah, And she was, he put through the bill that said the type of trading Enron was doing, which essentially was selling energy on the spot market, not the futures market, was not to be regulated. And he put through that law. And Enron, we saw what happened to Enron. She never went to jail with any of the other people. Came out smelling basically like a rose. And that's probably the most egregious I've ever come across.
Tons of them. In fact, Wayne, for years, used to run on his website. What was it? What did you call it? In fact, I think I gave him the name.
Political incest. Media incest chart.
Yeah, and he'd have all this stuff. But I want to go back to one of his little jokes at my expense and tell a real-life story. He was talking about me not having to watch traffic because I live on the same side of the street as the press clubber. But here's an actual story. One day we went to listen to somebody talk at the Washington Post here, and as we're leaving the Washington Post office, maybe taking a shortcut across the park, I said, well, let's cross the street here. And Wayne refused to do it in the middle of the block. And here's what his reasoning is, and this actually happened. He said, look, I know that there are people who are trying to kill me, but if they're going to run me over, I at least want to go in a crosswalk so they get a ticket if they kill me with their car. And we went up to the end of the block to walk through the crosswalk.
All right, so what's the story with the new Fed chairman? I listened yesterday, and I don't know, maybe I'm just getting crazy my whole life, but he sounded like some football coach. We're really going to go after this inflation. No, I mean it. Really, really going to go after this inflation. And, you know, just like the guys are going to tackle harder and block harder now that I'm the coach. It sounded like he never gave any sort of idea of how he was going to do that, other than put some committees together, which are useless.
Useless, yeah. So the spousal or child stuff, it would take a little bit of complicated wordsmithing to figure out how to do it. That would probably be too boring to attempt right here on the show. But the main thing is, do they want to do it, or do they want to pretend to do it? And, you know, I think a lot of people in the public, certainly me and Wayne, and I'm sure you, say, let's just do it. And we can wordsmith it later, but let's not get bogged down in details before we have a commitment to solve the problems.
Well, I mean, it again, we'll save this for next time. It's a massive topic, obviously. I was on a board. I was on a group that wrote a thing together for Nancy Sheehan when she ran for treasurer. And we got a group together. We actually put, imagine this, guys, we put a 30-page pamphlet together what she was going to do in office. And I wrote the finance part, which was pretty easy because all you could do is invest in government bonds, so that didn't take me all that long. Maybe it took me 20 minutes, but it was pretty well read or written. I mean, if I do say so myself. And there's this guy on the committee, and he's kind of a dumpy dude, I mean, a decent enough guy. And he was at the county, he was in the basement of the county building, and he did condemnations. And I'm like, okay, and I'm sure he made not very much, but every condemnation in the whole county went across his desk, and people might say, what the hell is this chief guy talking about? Well, if you're going to widen Irving Park Road, you have to condemn 15 feet of everybody's property, or 20, or whatever it is. You have to offer these people dough. Well, there's legal people, lawyers, that will say, oh, no, that's not enough. We'll try and get you some more, and we'll take, 30% of the difference. It doesn't cost you a dime, or 25, wherever their commission is. And he's telling me these law firms, there's a couple of them specialized in that practice, are the single biggest, most profitable law firms in the entire area. Nobody even knows who these guys are. And here it is, this guy's making $45,000 a year sitting at a metal desk in the basement of the county building. I mean, and he's approving this stuff. It's somewhere you got to go, wait a minute. On one side of the desk, the guys are making $50 million a year. There's this guy kind of directing it. The atmosphere is ripe for something, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is, but the solution has to be multi-factored.
Yes, yes.
And let me go back to our sports themes and part of what you were talking about with Lou in the previous segment. But in the National Basketball Association's gambling investigations, one of the guys caught up is a 6'1" guard, Terry Rozier, who has played for the Miami Heat, and he was making $20 million a year. And whether it's through some gambling compulsion or greed, he's now, I think, awaiting trial. But, he's making $20 million a year, and he allegedly wanted more. Now, that can't be solved just by...
Oh, I agree.
Give him $21 million a year, and then he won't gamble. It's got to be a variety of pressures and incentives and enforcement. These public officials.
Lewis said on a couple of occasions that Major League Baseball, that union, they could go on strike, and the owners are, don't want it to happen. Is it in football, all these guys are broke. Not all, but a lot of them are broke by the beginning of the season. If they want to strike for a month, they're calling their agents for a loan. They can't. The difference in a lot of the people, not everybody, is dramatic. It's not like we might go on strike next year. I'm only going to spend $2 million of this $8 million I made. It's gone. Where does it go?
Yeah, I mean, people match their lifestyle to their money. And here's a real chestnut for any old
timer. You know what you just did? I'm thinking,
what?
If one of you two guys or both started making $10 million a year, I'd love to see what would Wayne do? Would he go buy a yacht?
No, I mean, we'd
fly out there in our private jet to meet you for happy hour.
I think it partly comes from what you think is fun. So, briefly before we get to that, I was going to say that I still remember on the back of a baseball card from the 1950s, and I think it was a New York Yankees pitcher, Bob Grimm. They said in the off season, Bob helps his father tend bar, and I'm, this is a guy's a starting pitcher for the New York Yankees, and in the off season, the most interesting thing he has to say is he helps his father as a bartender. Well, that's a different world than now. I mean, but going back to what's fun, well, I had a pal. In fact, he was my sports buddy from high school, and he really made it big, and he had a big fancy, he had numerous houses, and I could go to them anytime I wanted. One was in Southampton, and it was the nicest mansion in Southampton, New York, and it was great when I'd go there and hang out, three or four pools, but I almost never did, because why is that? I mean, he and his wife were very entertaining, great fun to be around, but at some point I want to live my life. Why would I want to fly around? I mean, the air conditioner for just one of these places was a unit that was it was humongous. It was like 10 feet. So you got to pay attention to fixing that stuff and all that. Why?
Well, at that level, the house owns you.
It's not worth it. And so these people who are insane levels of money making. What is it?
How did you pick the pool on a given day? Did you rotate?
Just whatever you feel like. But at some point. By the way, at one point I asked his house manager, I said, I made some long distance calls. How much would that be? And the guy looks at me like I'm nuts. And I said, well, no, I want to pay, And he says, nobody has ever offered to pay.
He's probably right about that. So does a different pool shape match a different mood?
Well, let me get one more story. Boy, I'm yakking too much here. But at one point, I meet him in New York, and we go to the helicopter pad on the east side.
Oh, that's a rather infamous place.
Let me finish the story. We're running out of time here. So he points to an adjoining helicopter, and he says, that's the helicopter of Steve Ross, who's head of Warner Brothers. He says, we race our helicopters out to Southampton about this time every Friday. So we get in the helicopter, we go out to, enjoy a weekend. And then about 3 months later, I see the Steve Ross, the helicopter guy, famous CEO, big shot, has died of cancer at, maybe age 60. And I'm thinking, well, you can be rich, you can have the helicopters race out to Southampton, but father time is undefeated. So how are we going to spend our time?
So did you hang out in the bars in Southampton?
I did. Boy, I got two great stories. At one point, I was standing next to this tall, handsome guy in one of the great bars, and none of the young ladies talked to either one of us, and somebody said, do you know he's the model for, some big advertising campaign? And I thought, well, he's not getting any more attention than me. And the other story was my friend, and I'll mention his name, Bob Sillerman, who owned a lot of radio stations and concert venues and so forth. But he had these fabulous New Year's parties, and we're all drinking buddies from high school, and he had an entire bar in one of his mansion there, named after his father. He called it Mickey's Place. And after putting on this fabulous New Year's party, at about 12:30, everybody goes home. And so we thought, what a waste. And here was our great idea. Now, let me run it by the jury here. We thought, these people are getting old. How can we bust their balls? So after another drink or two, we said, why don't we call them up one by one and turn up the music as if the party's still going on. Say, we hope we got home safe, as if we're interrupting at 2:30 in the morning. The party's still going on, and they're all farts. They went home, but we're so concerned that we're worried that they got home all right. And we had a great time, just the two of us, calling up the guests at 2:30.
So now you guys are older. You guys are older than those old farts.
Well, that's the point. That's the fun. God.
So is this new Fed chairman going to do anything? I think he does nothing.
Right.
He doesn't need
Trump.
Trump doesn't need Trump anymore.
He doesn't need Trump anymore. And Trump, over in France, they said, well, how do you feel? He didn't lower the interest rates. And he says, I forget the exact quote, but Trump said, well, that's the way it goes, I guess.
Well, I mean, if they want to do anything with inflation, we all know what they have to do, and they're not going to do it. There's no way they're going to do it. The powers are too big. I dabble in this stuff a lot. If you were serious, you'd come in and you'd say, all right, guys, money supply is going to grow at 2%. That's it. We're going to put the reserve requirement back up to like 10 or 15%. There is none now. You know, by the way, we're going to let the balance sheet run off. There's no way the man could make that statement. And that's what he has to do. And he won't do it. I mean, am I right or not?
Hey, he's playing for an audience of one, really. I mean, I think with Trump, it was more his personal dislike and vendetta for Jerome Powell, more than even the policy stuff. You know, when he decides he doesn't like somebody, it's like a mob boss saying, you know, I'm not going to rest easy until the guy's sleeping with the fishes in the East River, you know?
Powell did everything Trump wanted him to do, my opinion.
Yeah, right, right.
I mean, he's blown the money supply up, whatever. Guys, terrific stuff. Maybe next week we can design a whole new political system that actually works. We'll see. Anybody... What he called the guy? Who's this guy from Maine that he called a Nazi?
Plattner.
Yeah.
What's his story? He's kind of a weird duck, isn't he? Plattner?
Well, he's a combat veteran from Afghanistan and Iraq. He had a problem with drinking and whatnot, but, he says he's reformed, but, you know, he's running against a very corrupt Susan Collins. And here's a case where the people that don't like Plattner are from out of state, and the people in the state are saying, well, wait a minute, we don't like people from outside coming in and talking about one of our own. Yeah. So there may be a kind of a blowback effect on this Senate race.
Is that thing a toss-up or not? Or no?
The polls are close, yeah.
Right. But at this stage, for him to be ahead against an incumbent is very, very promising for him. And his chief attacker is a political operative and in the day job. Plus, the guy used to be a bartender at a dive bar that Wayne and I know. So we'll see. But I think he's in pretty good position unless a provable scandal emerges beyond.
Well, we got a dash, but from what I've read, the House maybe won't flip. What is the Senate? I mean, they're not a blue wave that I can see here.
There could be.
Really, we're way over time here, but the way I think a number of us see things is, unless there's voter suppression in a massive way, you know, seizing registrations and so forth, I think it's more likely than not that the Democrats win the Senate.
And Lindsey Graham is in trouble in South Carolina.
Well, it just seems like, last dumb comment from me, but it seems like just when you sit there and go, oh, everybody's pissed off at, you know, who's ever in the office every 4 years or 2 years, it seems, that it's all going to go the other way. But you look at individual people, a lot of them are just locked in. I mean, there's not that many change.
I mean, there could be.
There could be, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about the old throw the bums in instead of throw the bums out. Yeah, I think this could be a different year. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. That. Guys, thank you very much. Have a nice weekend. SP Futures up 61. NASDAQ Futures up 470 now. We've gone back. Everything we got back from the NASDAQ yesterday, almost everything in the S&Ps. We'll see if that lands. No show tomorrow. It's Juneteenth. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.